Welcome, I'm Gary Parr, and this week's Fiber Talk show is sponsored by the Embroiderers Guild of America and Needle in a Haystack. And before we get to our conversation with Nicola Jarvis, check out the Embroiderers Guild of America, egausa.org website. Consider becoming a member. I know I became a member at large here not too long ago and have really enjoyed the benefits of the EGA and what they have to offer. To encourage you to go to the EGA website, I'm going to have a little drawing this week, and the winner will receive a Fiber Talk Made Me Buy It t-shirt, and that has to be large, extra large, or double XL. I don't have any smaller mediums left. So a t-shirt and two needle minders. And what I'm asking you to do is go to the galleries at egausa.org, the Stitches Across the Site section. And in there, I want you to find your favorite stitched piece, favorite design, and send me a photo of it. So if you're a Mac user, you just right-click and say download photo, and then just email that to gary@wetalkfiber.com. And the subject line, just put EGA. So EGA, and send me your favorite photo, favorite piece from Stitches Across the Site section of the galleries at egausa.org, and that'll put you into a drawing for a t-shirt and a pair of needle minders. And then while you're at the website, check out the Master Craftsman programs. They have 10 different programs: beading, canvas embroidery, counted thread, crewel embroidery, quilting, silk and metal threads are just some of them. Check that out, because if you want to advance your stitching and get recognized for it, the Master Craftsman program is an excellent way. And then if you're not sure if you want to be a member, or if you're a member and haven't checked it out, be sure and visit the free projects section. And in there are 15 free projects of all different techniques. And there are also two books you can download, two PDF books you can download. One is How to Color Wash Needlepoint Canvas. That's by Kate Gaunt. And then the other is a little book of embroidery basics from Patricia Lufholm. That's 66 pages of basics on embroidery techniques. That's a handy little thing to have that you can share with someone who's interested in beginning embroidery. So both of those are free, in addition to 15 free projects. So visit egausa.org, consider becoming a member, go to the Stitches Across the Site gallery section, send me a photo of your favorite piece to get in the drawing for a t-shirt and needle minders, and then definitely go to the free project section. Then when you get your project and you need materials, then you're going to go to Needle in a Haystack, that's needlestack.com, and get your materials from Kathy Ray. Now, Needle in a Haystack is one of my favorite businesses, online store, but you have to go to California to get in the store, but online, tremendous collection there that Kathy has of threads, ground cloth, and all the tools to go with them, especially if you're looking for something that's unusual, hard to find, good chance Kathy has it. Check it out. If you don't have a store nearby and you want to change colors in a project, Kathy can help you with that. Can't find a thread? Need a substitute? Kathy can help you with that. So needlestack.com, Needle in a Haystack. And also, while you're there, be sure and check out the things that Kathy is doing with her laser cutter. She has several pin keeps, needle keeps, and needle books that she is doing with the laser cutter. She really does a beautiful job, too. They're not just some thrown together quickly piece with rough edges. She does a beautiful job. The thread keeps alone, there's plenty of space to have to put your threads in and get to them easily. She's a stitcher. She understands what you need. And she has some specifically for hats, Hands Across the Sea sampler charts, Jane Fittis and 1835 and Mary Carter 1712. She has needle keeps, thread keeps, and needle minders for that. So if you want to coordinate, if you're stitching one of those and want to coordinate your accessories, go to Needle in a Haystack and get those. So thanks to both of our sponsors, EGA, Embroiderers Guild of America, and Needle in a Haystack. And now I hope you'll enjoy the conversation I had with Nicola Jarvis of Nicola Jarvis Studio. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. And our artist this week from Nicola Jarvis Studio, the Nicola Jarvis. Hi, Nicola.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. Okay, now I look at you. I studied you. Well, yeah, I did. I do it all the time. I get sucked right in and don't stop. Now, you've been doing this a long time.
Do you know, I guess I have,
yeah,
actually.
You have.
When you kind of, you look back and you count the years that you've been, you know, working within the field, and you realize this is nearly three decades, 30 years. It's whoa. That really is a whole career almost, isn't it?
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, you don't, and I'm sure you just don't realize it. You're just going thing to thing to thing, and the days go by and the weeks go by, and you just don't realize. Yeah.
And that's absolutely how it is. And then suddenly when you're updating your CV, or you're just reassessing sort of where you've been and where you're going.
What that's happened?
Wow. I'm, you know, 55. Oh my.
Yeah. So what is it? But the question that popped into my head on my bike ride this morning was, what is it that keeps you going? Is it the designing? Is it the teaching? Is it just, you just enjoy stitching in all aspects? What drives you to keep going? Because, you know, at some point, 30 years of doing this kind of thing, you know, I think you'd start to have thoughts about, you know, I just want to sit in my living room and stitch and just be left alone.
Yeah. And some people do have that feeling at certain points, don't they? When they've worked in a career for,
right,
for a long period of time. But I think, Gary, with me, I have such a drive to make and create and to visualize and realize a lot of ideas that I have in my head, that just keeps spurring me on. I have this excitement about making what comes into my imagination happen, either in a drawing or a painting or an embroidery or a combination of all three of those things. And it's just this deep, deep need to keep pouring out this visual material, I guess,
yeah,
you know, that comes out in either a pencil drawing or a fabric painting or an embroidery of one sort or another.
Yeah. So, okay. So you're one of those that your head is just so full of stuff, you can't get it out fast enough.
Yep. That's about the long, tall and short of it, Gary. And I think when they nail the lid on the coffin, that, you know, they might be able to push, you know, that lid down, and my ideas might just sort of, you know, stop seeping out. Who knows, you know?
Yep. Well, I mean, it's fun because artists, yeah, as I do more and more, you can almost categorize them, and there is that group of artists like you that it just doesn't stop. You just keep seeing it. It just keeps coming to your head, and you have to get it out in one form or another, and you have to share it. And I mean, it's fun. It's fun, but I can see how that would drive you. It would just, I can't stop because there's more.
Yeah. Absolutely. And for one idea, there are 10 more jiggling in that queue to jump out, you know, and you, a lot of the time you've got to be selective. And I try and note and make notes and do sketches of all of the things that come into my mind. And it might even be a word or a sentence. I try to just sort of lock the idea or that image down, and then I can go back to the sketchbook or that page where I've noted those things, and then make a selection from, you know, that day's ideas,
uh-huh,
of which one that I want to push forward, one or two of those that I want to pursue, let's say. So there is a selection process as well as all of this sort of spiel that sort of keeps tumbling out.
So you're one with sketchbook, piece of paper, always jotting down ideas then?
Absolutely I am, and always have, Gary. And in my studio, I have a big bookcase, and on two of those shelves, say a meter long, on two of those shelves are 35 years worth of sketchbooks.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, I, you know, every now and then, let's say every sort of 6, 9 months, a year, I will sit on the floor and pull a few out and go back down memory lane, you know, of the ideas that I might have had in 1985 and the ideas I might have had in 2007. You know, it's fascinating, interesting to see which ones, you know, actually made it into an object or a piece of work. And others that just stayed in the sketchbook pages, but it's all part of the process and the 30-year journey.
And those little sit downs then generate more ideas, I assume.
There you go. Yes.
Just feeding the meter.
Yep, that's it. That's right.
Oh, now, I love the story where, as a little girl, you learned sign painting from your dad.
And it's very sweet. You know,
that's just a tremendous start to me.
It's sweet, isn't it? And my dad was, he's still with us. He's still alive. I don't see him much, Gary. In fact, I saw him 2 years ago. He lives in Munich now. Mm. He was a very driven man, driven by two really strong, what would I call it? Music and art. He was a jazz musician and an artist, both. He could play the jazz trumpet by ear, and he could paint like an angel. And he is a very talented man. And for a living, at the beginning of my mum and dad's marriage, he was a sign writer, traditional sign writer for shops and for public houses. He would paint murals on public house walls and restaurant walls and pub windows and restaurant windows. And he used to do a lot of the work in a tumble down old garage at the bottom of our garden in Rugby. And the garage didn't have any doors on it, so it was just like an open big shed. And he would stand there and paint these signs in, you know, with his hands, Gary. There was no sort of laser, you know, printing or anything like that there is today. It was all with the oil paint and a beautiful roll of the most wonderful sable brushes. And he would chalk everything out on the boards. And Gary, as a little tiny girl, I would just stand and watch him. I would just stand and watch, mesmerized or curious, you name it. And he would explain things here and there. And he'd have a cigarette hanging out of the corner of his mouth while he was doing it. And off he went. And I think you do learn a lot by watching people, don't you?
You
do things, craftspeople. And my mum used to say to me when we were in the kitchen together, watch me cook. You sit and watch me. You'll learn a lot before you get stuck in. And she was right, Gary. You know, I learned all my cooking from her by watching her. And I learned a lot of the artistic techniques from my dad by watching him. And I was, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, Gary. So very young.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that was one of the pieces of advice I got during my early days as a magazine editor. An old veteran just said, one tip I can offer you, shut up and listen. You might learn something.
There you go. I'm with him. And it is right, isn't it? I'm testament to that, Gary, I guess. But I can talk for England.
Okay. Well, that's all right, too. So that, I mean, he's really, when it comes to sign making, that's in the day when that was truly an artist there. When,
because
you're not doing computer graphics and all those things. I mean, that's just steady hand and straight lines and all that.
And Gary, knowledge of typefaces and fonts that he would freehand draw with chalk. I mean, it was beautiful. And you know, what a sort of personal culture to have come from. You know, when I look back at that, I think I was blessed to have been brought up in that environment. And I it's not a surprise that I've learned to do what I do today and have the style that I have. It's very much rooted in those early years by watching him.
Yeah, and well, obviously there's a genetic artist in you, But yes, it still has to. Yeah. But it still has to come out somehow. And
it has to be nurtured, doesn't it? And it has to be encouraged and supported. And it's sort of nature and nurture, isn't it? And there is a very, very strong artistic line on my dad's side of the family. Painters, church stained glass window painters.
Oh.
And guys, my grandfather's, who would paint on church walls as well. So they would, you know, paint on the walls behind the altars.
Mm-hmm.
And also there were tailors in that side of the family as well, Gary. So, you know, we have the needle and thread and we have the paintbrush, don't we?
Boy, you were armed right out of the gate.
Really? You know, when you see it's unsurprising when we start to look at it all, isn't it?
Yep.
And I feel very honored, you know, that I've been able to continue the line for so long, you know, and been able to make it a career or a living from it, let's say.
Yeah. Now, did that, obviously you were intrigued and interested at that age. Did that trigger your art interest? Did you carry art all the way through school and
yes.
Explore it?
Yeah, I really did, Gary. I was very hungry. I was just really, really interested. It was, you know, just a very natural interest. I am a very visual person. You know, I love color. I love design. It was all around me as a child. You know, mum and dad had what I would say would be great taste. And, you know, they loved art and artists and their interior design flair was supreme. My dad he could turn his hand to anything, Gary. So he was also a builder. He could, you know, build a fireplace. He could build a wall. He could put in windows. So he, you know, they had lots of ideas. They had great flair. And so, you know, I think that's sort of where I that appreciation and that love and interest came. It was fostered there and off it went, you know.
Yeah.
I was always interested in it, you know. So not a surprise that I would be.
Right. Well, yeah, you almost don't have a choice.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, when I first ran into you, which has been some time now, just following your Instagram and the embroidery, and I've kept tabs on you a long time, but I did not realize the drawing and the painting that goes along with that, and because oftentimes people will migrate toward just embroidery or needle arts of some kind, and maybe the drawing supports that. But you continue in all those ventures in one way or another.
Yeah. The art practice, the design and the drawing and the art practice it's actually probably the core of it's my core. It's my first response, if that makes sense, and it's the thing that I will start with. So it's something I can't stop doing. I think we said it at the beginning of our conversation. I'm sort of on the end of this flow, a bit like a river, and the drawing and the painting comes first, and then the stitching knowledge, which I gained, you know, I bolted the stitching knowledge onto the drawing and the art flair, if that makes sense,
right.
The artistic vein that runs through me. And the embroidery feeds into that artistic practice. The embroidery became a fascinating language to work with and to explore in terms of making visual images.
Right. Well, it just becomes another medium for you, basically.
Correct.
Then.
Yeah. Absolutely. Another way of mark making, or another way of building up a texture, either on a page or on a piece of fabric. Absolutely.
Do you find that you express yourself better with needle and thread than, say, with oil paint?
Oh, a great question. I think I love them for the different reasons and the different possibilities and the different limitations that they have. I'm one of these sort of polymaths when it comes to media. I enjoy it all for its different characteristics, and I enjoy sort of exploring the different media. And I like to mix them up as well, Gary. I like to cross things over.
Yes, so, I've noticed. Yes.
Yeah. It's great fun. It's great fun.
Well, and see, that's what, for me, what puts it at a different level. And I've talked to others who do this, where it's the expression of the art that's in your head, and the medium doesn't matter. It's whatever gets the job done. So if it's a combination of paint and thread or gold work or whatever it is that gets the job done, that's what you use, rather than saying, I just do surface embroidery and I'll find a way to make it work that way. You don't have that approach at all.
No, exactly. And you've nailed it just then. Yeah, it's what gets the job done. And it's knowing that what can get the job done as well, Gary.
Yes, yes.
And that takes years. That takes time, because you have to understand your materials and you have to understand your techniques. And that takes an awful lot of investment. But it's a fabulous path that, you know, I've been on, and I'm still on it, Gary. I feel like I'm still a baby and I'm still learning. And I almost feel like, yes, okay, I've worked for 30 years, but oh my goodness, I hope there's another 30 years ahead of me. You know, I've got so much more that I want to express and I want to explore. You know, it's right. Really exciting.
Yeah. Now, you, everybody I've talked to who worked in the fashion industry left it. And of course, I'm talking to needleworkers, so of course they left it. But help me out there. Did the fashion industry work come before Royal School?
It came after Gary.
Okay.
Yeah, it came after the training. I mean, I've never left the Royal School.
Right. I get that feeling too, that all of you Royal School people are, it's like this club. Do you ever leave it? I mean,
no, I don't think any. Well, I think some people do. I think life takes them away from it, you know, very happily, and they go off and do other things. But I think those of us that do stay close to it or have a connection with it, someone said to me once, I think it's wonderful, she's like an eccentric old aunt. She's fascinating and you still keep wanting to visit her because she's really interesting and she's got loads of stories. You know, it's something like that for me, definitely. And I value the training that I gained at the school, and the skills that I gained, you know, I gleaned there and I've built on, are invaluable in terms of how that's helped me to shape my career and to shape my art practice. So I hope I'm always connected to it. It's quite a small connection now, Gary, because I'm so busy doing my own thing. But I still do go back and teach there, and I love going back because I really enjoy everyone that works there. I love Hampton Court Palace, and I think what the embroidery that the school teaches is beautiful. So, you know, it's a positive and very enjoyable relationship that I have with the Royal School of Needlework.
Yeah, I get that sense every time. And I'm sure it's born out of the intensity of work when you first arrive and to get whatever certificate degree that you earn. And it doesn't seem to matter what level people finish at. It's the same result. In that if you're there and you succeed all the way through, then it becomes part of you. And then even if you don't go back, if you go away and do your own needlework thing and rarely connect, I think I just get a sense that it's always there in the back of your head, that it's the foundation that from which you everything comes.
Yeah, it really is, in terms of the embroidery, in the way that you make your stitching, and in the way that you teach that, you go on to teach that stitching, if teaching is what you continue to do, there is very much a common thread between all of us practitioners from the school, and as you say, it is a club, and a very rewarding club as well, and you know, we all have friendships within it, and I've had a great time there, Gary. You know, I've had lots of laughs. I've had a few tears when things didn't go right, you know, both with my own work and when I was actually working there, you know, as an employee. either as a designer or a teacher or on, you know, the foundation degree. But the challenges, I think, as difficult as some of them were at the time, and there weren't a huge amount, they sharpen you up. They, mm-hmm. you know, they really make you resourceful. They make you pull on parts of yourself that, you know, perhaps you haven't exercised much. Or so, yeah, I think it's the good and the not so good is important as right. well.
Yeah, yeah, and I've had that sense that, sure, you come out of there highly skilled needleworker, but there's another aspect of it that serves you almost equally well as you go out to develop your own career. And just that is that you get toughened up a little bit. And,
you really do.
Yeah, and that's incredibly valuable. Better to learn it there than when you're running a business.
Well, it was like the apprenticeship, Gary, before I went into the fashion industry. The apprenticeship was a full-time, full-on, intense job. It was a job. We were paid, albeit not so much. You know, it wasn't a huge wage, but we were paid to train as traditional hand embroiderers. And mm-hmm. we stumped up at those frames at 9 o'clock in the morning, and we left at 5 o'clock at night, Monday to Friday, for 3 years, Gary. And so if that doesn't, you know, if that doesn't make for a really solid work ethic, robust, you know, then I don't know what does. And it really girded me for the fashion industry. Yeah. It, you know, and the fashion industry is cut and thrust, as you've probably heard,
quite
ruthless. And it did. It the training at the school really helped me in the 10 years that I worked, you know, in the British fashion industry. It was a roller coaster ride. It was a fabulous one, but, you know, you were fated one day and dropped the next, Gary.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that.
Well, let's go back to the school, though. What gets you into the school? Where?
So 30 years ago, what got me into the
school? That isn't something that just walks into your door at some point. You know, you have to make a choice.
You make a conscious decision. And I was 25 when I decided that was what I wanted to do. And the Royal School of Needlework was where I wanted to go. So 25 was quite late to be making up your mind at that point.
Right.
You know, back in the early 90s, deciding what you wanted to do with yourself. All my friends and all of the apprentices that I then went on to study with were a lot younger than me, Gary. I was a bit of a late developer. And the thing with me was I was kicking my heels in the air and drinking and smoking and gallivanting around for 7 odd years. Yeah, I was working, but having a great time while I was, you know, working as a barmaid or a waitress. And then I walked into the Victoria and Albert Museum in 1990 and walked into the textile gallery and was basically stopped in my tracks by the most fabulous Jacobean crewel work bed curtain and a stunning raised work jacket that was worn by a merchant's wife called Lady Margaret Layton. And those two objects, I would say, Gary, changed the course of my life because my jaw dropped on the floor and I just thought they're the most beautiful things I have seen. And I want to draw them, but I also want to learn how to make them.
So that was your moment.
That was the
moment. Drinking, smoking, and tromping around bars, and that was your moment.
That was where that kind of became, you know, less important, and the embroidery and the design was just in the forefront of my mind, and I wanted to chase that. I wanted to go and find out more. So I found the Royal School of Needlework, and I applied for the 3-year apprenticeship. And what they were looking for, the principal at the time, Elizabeth Elvin, and her teachers, were looking for somebody with a design acumen, you know, a facility with color and composition, but that someone who hadn't necessarily picked up a needle and thread.
No bad habits.
Correct. That's what she said. That's what she said. I had two interviews. I had my initial interview with the boss, and I took a portfolio of drawings, And then she invited me back for a second interview, and I had that with the boss and four other of the technical teachers.
Ooh, that's a little intimidating, huh?
It was, but you know what, Gary? You know when something feels right and you want something so bad that you'll do anything? That interview was, it just felt right, Gary. And they liked my work. They liked the drawings and the paintings. And they just needed to be convinced that a 25-year-old was going to stay the course.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed to be convinced that, you know, their expensive training, because it costs thousands of pounds to train us, was going to be an investment. And I just said, well, look, if you take a risk, I don't think, you know, I think you'll be paid, you'll be paid off. Mm-hmm. And I see the old boss now, Liz, and we laugh. And I said, did you risk pay off, Liz? And she just puts her arm around me and she laughs, Gary, gives me a hug. yeah, she's lovely.
Great.
She took a chance, Gary, and it paid off. Because you take a chance on some people and you don't know, do you?
Right.
And bless her, she didn't know. But, I proved it.
Yeah. Well, they saw something, clearly.
They must have done. That's it. And a collaboration, a good collaboration between you know, myself and the teachers. And that's what it's about, isn't it?
Yep. So you finish your apprenticeship and then you stay on and teach and work there
and
for
design.
A while?
Yeah. Yep. Designing and teaching both, because they are my strengths, Gary, the designing first. But what I hadn't realized until I was studying on the apprenticeship, that I really had a flair, a skill for passing on the knowledge, the skills.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the boss, the boss then, Elizabeth Elvin, who in my first year, she called me into her office in my first year and she said, I'd like to invite you to be my assistant to teach a gold work class at the end of your first year. And I could believe it, Gary. I mean, that was scary stuff, Gary.
Yeah, I'll say.
Are you sure? Oh, yeah. Yeah, you need to just be dropped in the deep end and you need to sink or swim. And I think you'll swim, but you just need to get on with it. And I was thinking, oh, my God, I don't know very much. And she said to me, you will be surprised how much you know and how much you can pass on. And you know what, Gary? I stepped into that classroom. I was quaking like a little leaf. And I watched her just go in. And there were about six or seven students. And it was she was a well-known gold worker, Liz Elvin, quite a reputation as a gold worker and ecclesiastical embroiderer. And I just watched her go in and guide and advise. And I thought, hey, I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And off I went. And that was it, Gary. That was it. June 1992, that was it. And I haven't looked back. I really did discover a skill or a talent at passing on the knowledge, if that makes sense. And I enjoyed it, Gary. I didn't realize how much I would. And I think when you enjoy something and you're enthusiastic about the subject, your students can't help but sort of really feed off that. And you feed off them in turn again, don't you?
Yep. Yeah.
And it's a cycle, isn't it?
That's so funny because there you are in your dad's paint shop again, only it's gold work. Yeah.
Indeed. Absolutely. Yeah. All these teachers, Gary, these teachers, they're really seminal in your life, aren't they?
Oh, they are. And I mean, I'm a former teacher, science teacher, and, you know, it's been years since I've taught. But to me, it's still when that door, when the bell rings, the door closes and it's just you and the students, there's nothing like it.
Fantastic, yeah. Isn't it? It's a very, very creative space, and it's not just dealing with the subject, it's dealing with so many other things, isn't it? Psychology and sociology and emotions and self-esteem. And I think in many ways, sometimes, and I say this a lot, it's more than teaching the subject. It's way more than that.
Oh, the subject is almost secondary, I think, sometimes.
Correct.
Yeah.
It really is. And just to make people feel good, that's both of you, your students making you feel good and you making them feel good. You can do so much, can't you, when you've got that really lovely energy going on?
Yeah. Oh, there's no doubt about it. And you're exactly right. It's a two-way street. It's not just you lecturing. There's an exchange that goes on and you learn from them. And anybody who talks about a teacher they remember, it's enthusiasm. That's what carried the day. The teacher was excited about doing and sharing and working with the students. And yeah, that just feeds off of everything. Yep.
Doesn't it? Doesn't it, Justin? As you say, they're the ones you remember and the ones that just sort of throw you off on a trajectory that you perhaps hadn't even thought that you were going to be embarking on.
Right. Right. So then you dug right in with this Goldwork class and you saw what needed to be done and just went for it.
Yeah, and I loved it, and I buzzed. I really buzzed like I hadn't buzzed for a while, to be honest, Gary, you know. And so that was something I discovered there and then that was something that I'd go on to develop was the teaching practice and go on to actually formally study teaching as, you know, subject, education as a subject, mm-hmm. which I found fascinating. And then, you know, develop then the embroidery teaching alongside sort of building it in with the understanding of what, you know, what it was, how you impart your knowledge and how you manage a classroom and how you design a course or a lesson. You know, great skills. I loved my teacher training and haven't regretted investing, you know, the 3 years that I did. For one moment, I felt it really strengthened and enriched what my embroidery knowledge and, you know, the way that I passed it on.
Oh, I have no doubt because, yeah, once you understand the mechanics and the foundations of teaching, then that really, you can really take off then. Yeah, that's, but you almost, to be successful, I think you almost have to have that shown to you in one way or another.
Because it's not always obvious, is it?
No.
Even though sometimes you're doing it automatically, you're doing it already, to be shown new tools and new techniques in terms of motivation and retention and people taking ownership of a particular element of their learning, that all does have to be broken down and spelled out and built back up again, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, yeah, exactly. All of that and fundamental to all of it is simply understanding the different ways that people learn and having the awareness to select out the students who need to learn visually, who need to learn by reading, who need to be told, and being able to deliver that at all those levels.
That's right.
In a lot of times on the fly.
Mostly on the fly, Gary, especially when you're doing a class, just a day class, and you've got 5 hours with 20 people, and you've got to make those judgments in how, as you say, how they learn in, you know, it's split seconds sometimes, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, it's very fast, isn't it? That processing and then delivering. It's fascinating, isn't it, really, that, you know, we do some of it automatically and some of it we pull on, you know, the studies that we had to undergo.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. That's, to me that, well, a lot of things. I mean, I've often said I would go back to teaching tomorrow given the chance, but there's so much other stuff that goes with it that there's no way I'd do it. But, it's that when you stand up and scan a classroom, and your mind is identifying those students and saying, all right, I can see that person struggling and I know that person needs to learn visually. I need to go over there and show and then get that person off the dime and moving forward. And to be able to do that person to person, it's incredible fun. It's incredible fun.
It is, Gary, you're absolutely right. It is challenging. It's, as you say, you get a real buzz from it. You're going round that classroom a bit like a sort of circus master, aren't you, in a way?
Yes.
You
know? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Keeping all your plates spinning, aren't you?
Yep.
And making sure everyone's happy and are progressing, you know, in the way that they want to. And as you say, it's hard work, isn't it? But it's so fulfilling as well.
Yeah. No, I say that people complain about teachers, you know, they work 9 months of the year and all those things. And my response to them every time is, I don't want to hear about it till you've done it.
That's it. You give so much as a teacher.
Yeah.
You give so much. It is everything. Yeah. And everything's sort of peaking, isn't it? And in that particular session, however long or short it is.
Yep.
But I've loved it, Gary. 30 years, I've loved it. However, Gary, COVID-19 has rendered my teaching null and void.
Yeah, well, that's a big club there.
Yeah, we're in a big club, aren't we, Gary? So we're all having to think along different lines in how we deliver and how we continue to pass on our knowledge. And I'm in that process at the moment of just sort of, you know, letting the dust settle and reassessing how I might go forward with that in terms of online.
Yeah, people are figuring it out, though. It's starting to emerge. People are getting past the technology and making the adjustments, and you can start to see it emerge, and people are starting to say, all right, I see how I can make this happen. Yeah,
it's really exciting. It really is. So, I'm on it myself. yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So then you moved to the cutthroat fashion industry.
Yeah, I did.
Well, that had to have been a ride.
It was a ride. And the thing is, I think because I'd been brought up with a very stylish, you know, parents who, you know, understood fashion both in interior and in clothing, because they like to wear nice things. They like to be up to the minute. You know, they like the house to look nice. I absorbed that, and I'd always been interested in embroidery on garments, and it was something I wanted to explore outside of the raw scroll and needlework. Mm-hmm. So it was something I wanted to pursue and just to see how far I could go with embroidery and the fashion industry in my own country.
So did you view that as a long-term career, or I'm going to take out of this what I can get?
I saw it as long term. I hoped when I started that I would stay in for a number of years. You know, I hoped it would be, I sort of had a sense it might be sort of 5 odd years, Gary, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted it to kind of, you know, I wanted to develop it and build it, which is what I did. And I, you know, I was in it for 9-10 years, absolute maximum. And it was very intense in that there are two, well, there were, when I was working in the industry sort of 15, 20 years ago, there were two seasons at that point. There was the autumn, winter and the spring, summer. Well, there's multiple seasons now, Gary. But when I was working, there were two, and you worked in February would be that month of January and February would be intensively for spring, summer. And then the August, September would be for the autumn, winter. And you'd be working sort of all night, all day, Gary, for 2 months. You know, everyone wanted things yesterday. I'd have those courier bikes waiting, you know, revving their engines on my doorstep, waiting for me to finish garments and samples for fashion shows and buying reviews. Mm-hmm. So it was hard, hard graft. But when I had work, Gary, they paid me very, very well.
Oh, okay.
But it was feast or famine.
Yeah. and those shows are the engine, right?
Yeah. And those 4 months that I was working, you know, almost 24 hours a day, almost, let's, you know, not quite, but nearly, that money that I earned in those 4 months would have to then last me across the whole year.
Right.
So it was feast or famine. And that's quite scary, you know. It's it's quite a sort of nail biting way of living. But you know, I was determined to do it because I found the work really exciting, and I found what the designers did with needle and thread and the cutting edge materials that they used. Uh-huh. You know, I just found that I was learning so much and gaining so much knowledge for my own sort of artistic practice that I just wanted to stay in it for as long as I could.
Yeah. So what do you take out of that serves you today?
Breaking the rules, I suppose.
Oh, okay.
Doing things, unlikely things, unusual things with embroidery, using unlikely materials, plastics, string, raffia, plant material, you know, you name it. They were there were all sorts of really weird and wonderful things that I was being given to create artworks on garments that I hadn't encountered at the Royal School of Needlework, which had been very, very traditional.
Mm-hmm.
And at the Royal School, I'd only worked with woolen threads, cotton threads, silk threads, and metal threads. That was about it, Gary.
Mm-hmm.
So the fashion industry, you know, with all its different kinds of sort of plastics and all different beautiful fibers and beautiful weaves of all different sorts and styles and prints. And it was such an education in its own right. And it just showed me that you could work with so many different materials, and you didn't have to stay in a very obvious sort of arena of just what was on offer, you know, in the haberdashery shops, if that makes sense.
So this fed right into what you do today, which is whatever it takes to deliver the vision you have.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely it did. Yeah, it really did. And that for me was, I think that was instrumental at that time of really feeding my practice without me really realizing that it was really going to come to fruition sort of 10 and 15 years on from that point.
Yeah. And I'm sure toughened you up like nothing else.
Yeah, it really did. I mean, the work ethic, I mean, it had been pretty damn good before, you know,
right,
the school. But, you know, I had to sing for my supper, Gary. And if I didn't do the work, I didn't get paid. And so, you know, and I had a mortgage at that point as well.
Whoa,
so I,
no pressure there.
So there was pressure on a lot of sides. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, tough but fantastic, exhilarating, I think is the word I'd use to describe that period.
Yeah. So and I assume doing your own embroidery and design along the way.
Yeah, and what I'd do alongside all the fashion work, what I'd get ideas from all the designers, you know, their drawings, their little samples, and the things that they gave me to create, you know, the garments and the swatches that they wanted. I would then go off and experiment on my own clothes. And, you know, I'd be sort of working with some of their ideas and some of, you know, their kinds of materials. I'd go and buy my own sort of equivalents. And I would turn up at a party or a dinner party or, you know, the pub in my own version of, you know, a Jasper Conran top or a Lulu Guinness handbag, you know. I was just experimenting with all the things I was learning from the designers, Gary, just taking it forward. And that was great fun too, you know, doing it on a personal level. So I got all my friends to say, could you do me one?
No.
Yeah, that's it.
Do you know how much time it took to do this one?
Gary,
no.
There is a soft side to me, Gary. There's a side that can't say no.
So this... When do you make the break? What triggers the break and says, all right, enough of fashion?
So what happened in 2004, I had the apprenticeship certificate and I had experience at the Royal School of Needlework in traditional hand embroidery. Then I had 10 years of incredible experience in the fashion industry. And there was a point just before I was 40 where I said to myself, I really want to go and use all this knowledge in a fine art setting. I want to go back to school and work with all this knowledge that I've gained over the last 15 years and start to develop my own practice. I was desperate, Gary, desperate. And so I took myself, I applied for fine art courses at the Slade Art School, at Newcastle University, at Glasgow School of Art, at Manchester School of Art. And I got accepted at Newcastle and Glasgow and Manchester, but it was Manchester Art School that I preferred when I went for the interview and I went for the open day. I just really enjoyed the atmosphere there. Mm-hmm. I really liked the tutors and the lecturers. And that was where I chose to study. And that's where I went and did a BA from the age of 40. so I went back to school. But I was also still working in the fashion industry and still teaching at the Royal School of Needlework to fund the BA,
uh-huh,
Bachelor of Arts. So, you know, I didn't stop working really, Gary. I was doing three jobs, the degree and the teaching and the fashion as well.
But you know what I take out of that? You never stop learning.
No, you don't. No, you don't. And I think, you know, I'll only stop learning, Gary, when I'm 6 feet under, or I'm, you know, that's it. When I've ceased to exist on this earth. And that's how I see it. And I just think learning is, gosh, there's so much to learn, Gary. The more I learn, the more I realize that I don't know.
What
I think so many people say that, but it's the truth, isn't it?
Yeah. So then now you're really armed. So you have all that experience, and you go back to school and get your BA. And then did you have that vision that I'm going to start my own business? I mean, that was your target?
It kind of happened. Gary, my wish, and my wish is still this, is to be recognized as an artist. I just want recognition as a person who makes art. And I wanted to be able to live by my art. And really, in 2004, 2005, 2006, when I was doing the BA, I imagined myself selling my artworks in galleries. I didn't for a moment ever think that I was going to be, you know, launching an embroidery kit business. That came later. And that's given me an incredible income stream. But I never actually dreamed of having my own little business doing that. I wanted to be a selling artist. And that's why I went back to school to try and develop that. But, you know, other things were coming together, and other things were, you know, lined up for me that weren't quite the vision that I had at that time. So after the BA, my tutors on the BA, they said to me, you know what, you are just on such a roll, and you have such a strong handle with drawing. You know, drawing's your language, and you need to just push it even further. Why don't you go and do a master's? And that's what I did, Gary. I applied to Wimbledon School of Art on their drawing masters and got in, and it was very, very competitive. It's a very tough course, tough to get on and tough to be on. Mm-hmm. But boy, do they whip you into shape. And they are, oh my gosh, they were brutal. They really were, Gary. I spent more time in tears on that course than I did, you know, feeling sort of relaxed and happy. But what they were doing were really, they were really sharpening us up, because the art world, like the fashion world, it is so tough. It's so saturated, isn't it, with talent. And you've got to be so hell-bent to be able to make it. And that's what they were doing with us.
Yeah.
They were just, you know, really trying to.
They were saving your bacon in the front end, yep.
Yeah, they really were. But what they did, Gary, is they made me realize what I was doing, why I was doing it, and how I was doing it. So I really located what it was I was up to, and it was very much using drawing and embroidery in order to express myself, you know, in the world, you know, my little world, if that makes sense.
So they helped you then step out of your little art bubble and see yourself from the outside and say,
yes,
all right, now, and put it in perspective for you.
Yeah. And to make us aware of what it's like to approach galleries or to exhibit your work, to market yourself, to publicize yourself. You know, they were training us to be a one-man band, publicist, you know, a maker, a publicist, an accountant. You know, they were teaching us to do everything that it took in order to be successful as a practicing artist and to make a living from it. And what happened was, at the end of the master's, the Royal School of Needlework was setting up a degree, as I think you're aware, that's what they have now, a very
right.
successful degree course. And in 2006 and 2007, I was invited to be part of a course writing team to design the Stitch curriculum. And then in 2009, once the course, just before the course was launched, they then advertised for personnel, for people to help run the course, teach it. And there was an opening for a Stitch curriculum designer, basically. And I applied for the job, and I got it, Gary, right at the end of my master's. So I finished my master's.
Timing is everything.
Timing is everything. And wow, what a fantastic job. What an opportunity, Gary, you know, bringing the teaching
Right.
And the stitch and the drawing together and helping young people to, well, situate their own practices, Gary.
Right.
Yeah. That's, yes. Yeah.
Amazing how it comes together, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. And so after 2 years of being, you know, the deputy course leader and the stitch curriculum designer, I saw an advert for a competition that was being run by the William Morris Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically inviting artists from all over London and the UK to make a piece of work inspired by William Morris. This was in 2010. So I was still, you know, working on the degree. And we had a summer holiday and I thought, you know what, I've spent a year with the students. I've done very little art practice. I need to get back on this. And so I made a piece of work for this competition run by the William Morris Gallery. And I won, Gary. I was awarded overall winner. And that was another point that changed the course of, you know, my life and career.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's no small thing to win, affiliated with the William Morris organization, to win something that has their name on it. That means something.
It was significant. And what it afforded me was my own solo exhibition 3 years from when I won the prize. Mm. That was the prize.
Oh, it was. Oh, so, oh boy.
Yeah.
Oh.
That was, yeah. I, you know, normally when you enter an art competition, normally there is a cash prize.
Sure.
For the first, second, and a few of the runners up. But this prize was not cash. It was an opportunity. And Gary, that opportunity has just served me over the last 10 years. I cannot tell you. It might as well have been 50 grand of cash, really, in the doors that it opened. You know, I can't quantify it really in money, but it's just been phenomenal in terms of raising a profile.
So the prize is effectively more work, but the payoff after that is significant.
Absolutely. You've nailed that one. Absolutely.
So is this where the birds come from?
Yes.
See, you're one of these people. Now we're going to run out of time. We're going to have to do another show because there's a whole bunch of stuff we have to explore.
I'll come and talk to you again, Gary. You just name the day and I'll
okay.
be there.
Okay. So tell how I got to know about the birds. Before we go, I got to know about the birds because,
okay.
Well, I mean, you know, that's what people talk about, but there's a reason for that.
The birds came from this William Morris exhibition. Well, William and May Morris, because it was the William Morris Gallery that hosted the exhibition. But the curator, who had been one of the people to help select me to you know, win the prize, she, when I won the prize and went and had a meeting with her, and she said, right then, Nicola, what are you going to do for this solo show in 3 years' time? And I said, well, do you know, I have heard about, and I know a little about her, a tiny little bit about this lady. Her name is May Morris, Mary Morris, and I believe she's William Morris's youngest daughter. And I've read that she was an embroiderer, and she was a teacher, and she was a lecturer, and she worked at the Royal School of Needlework just on a part-time, very part-time basis. She would go in and she did a bit of designing and a bit of lecturing for the Royal School. And I said, you know, there's a lot of parallels with her and myself. And I'd like to look at her instead of William Morris in terms of, you know, informing my exhibition. And she said, that'd be fantastic because May Morris has not enjoyed, you know, she's been in the shadows of her father because he is ubiquitous, isn't he?
Yeah, that's a big shadow.
You know, it's huge. And yet this lady, in her own right, Gary, was so accomplished. She's such a beautiful artist, a fabulous designer, a wonderful embroiderer.
Mm-hmm.
And the curator and myself and many others who are associated with the gallery said, it's about time we pulled her and all of her work out of the dusty archives and the collection and shook it out and shone a light on it and had a look at it again and reassessed it again in the 2000s. And so that's what I did. So what I did was I looked at a lot of her work. I went to the Ashmolean Museum, the archive and collection in the William Morris Galleries, and all of the stately homes like Whittick Manor and the Red House and Kelmscott House and Kelmscott Manor, those institutions and houses who hold a lot of her work, both embroidery and drawings and paintings, I got a real sense of what she was about and her style, which is very similar to her father. And I started to realize that she advocated that artists and designers should work from life in order to create original artworks and designs. She was a huge advocate of that. And so I started to draw plants and flowers from life. I started, you know, very much as she set down in, she wrote a book called Decorative Needlework. And she said, you must draw from life if you want to make original work. So I thought, right, I'm going to do what she says. I'm going to draw from life. So I started drawing all these plants and flowers, Gary, for months and months, lovely sort of botanical drawings, all very intricate. And I thought, well, these are very beautiful, but, you know, loads of people do this. It's not that original, is
it? Yeah, I was going to say.
What am I going to do with this?
Yep.
So I drew this beautiful anemone. It was 2011. It was April, and I thought, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to collage some William Morris and May Morris patterns onto the petals of this anemone flower. And I started to do that, and I thought, well, yeah, this is pretty. This is nice, but it's not really doing it for me. It's not really got the magic.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept doing my still life drawings and sort of playing around with the collaging of these patterns on these flowers. But alongside my still life drawings, Gary, I was watching the little birds in my garden as a light relief, as a way of relaxing between all this painstaking observational drawing. And I started to photograph my little robins and my little blue tits and my little blackbird and my little sparrows. And in the end, I had these lovely body of photographs of these cute little garden birds. And I thought, oh, they're so sweet. And I took the robin and I thought, what would happen if I collaged some William Morris patterns onto his head, his wing, his breast?
Mm-hmm.
And Gary, that's how it started. And suddenly I got my little robin with willow pattern wings and tulips on his head, you know, and that's the point where it all started to come together and make sense. And I started creating something that I thought had a real magic and sort of something that was very compelling. And Gary, from that point, it just literally, like the birds, it flew and they were born. And this whole sort of aviary of birds started to appear. Drawings that I then thought, oh my gosh, I've only got a year to stitch these, if that's what I want to do.
Oops.
Yeah, yeah. Oh my, and there's only me. So that's when you call on all your friends. And I emailed and called and said, guys, how do you fancy being part of a collaboration whereby if I send you a drawing, a color drawing of one of my little birds, all collage with William and May Morris patterns, would you like to stitch it in crewel and surface stitches and silk work and gold work? And I approached 30 stitchers, Gary, and 30 stitchers agreed to work with me.
Wow.
And what they got was the piece of work after the show, their name in lights, their name and work in the catalogue. So they had a spotlight as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a nice platform for them and a different, possibly a different way of working, you know, different colour palette, a different subject matter. And off we went, Gary, and without those 30 ladies and gentlemen, I wouldn't be where I am now, really. And that show was the richer for that collaboration.
Yeah. Oh, I can imagine that. Yeah. Yeah.
And I feel that's where the magic really started to happen, was my work with those stitchers. And the stitchers would use their own initiative and they'd write to me and say, hey, you know, you've drawn this here. What do you reckon about this instead of what you've put? Go for it. I'd say that's even better, you know, and off it's like teaching, off you go, don't you?
Right. No, that's so interesting. 'Cause you said those two words, Beth Ellicott and I have been talking, here recently in a couple of shows about creativity and what makes it, what kills it. And it's that what if. Like you sat there and you said, wait a minute, what if I take these birds and this thing I'm trying to do with this anemone, what if?
Yeah,
and really being, was. Yeah, being willing to just jump in and see what happens. Yeah.
Do you know what, Gary? There was a year I just had to start taking some risks, because what was driving me was the fact that there just wasn't that magic, you know, that stardust wasn't appearing.
Yeah.
And I had to force it a little bit, if that makes sense, you know. Well, but I also, I think
sometimes pressure brings out creativity. It's okay.
It totally does, doesn't it? And also your experience to spot that something that you take is a hunch, isn't it? You take a risk on something that you think, do you know what, this might just work.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, that's, however you get there, but I can understand the pressure to be doing something with the Morris people. And I mean, you can't just do an average exhibit. You got to deliver something. Yeah.
You have got to make a statement. You've got to sort of represent ideas, haven't you? You know, represent. Mm-hmm. They've got to be fresh, haven't they? They're not new. They're not original. Well, they are new, but they're represented in a different way, aren't they? It's a sort of remix of things, isn't it? That sort of seems fresh and new at the time, doesn't it?
Yep. No, that's well, it worked. Good for you. Yay.
Oh,
well, you and 30 other people. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, thank goodness.
Yep. Well, Nicola, we're going to have to stop there, but yeah, we definitely got to do another one.
It'd be lovely, Gary. Time has flown, hasn't it? When you're having fun and enjoying yourselves and you're having a great conversation, it just runs away, doesn't it?
It does at that. Yeah, when you mentioned before we started about we got to be ready to go for an hour, I thought, this will be over before you know it. Yep.
Well, a real pleasure, Gary. Lovely to talk to you. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been lovely to share parts of my life and my work with you.